This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Even before Colin Powell's presentation to the United Nations, my guest Peter Galbraith supported a war against Iraq to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Galbraith describes himself as a liberal interventionist. From 1979 to 93, he worked with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee as an advisor on the Persian Gulf, South Asia, and North Africa. For over a decade, he's worked closely with the Kurds, documenting Saddam Hussein's campaign against them. In 1992, Galbraith helped smuggle 14 tons of Iraqi documents out of the Kurdish region that outlined Saddam Hussein's atrocities against the Kurds. Galbraith is now a professor of national security studies at the National War College in Washington, D.C. In 1993, he became the first U.S. ambassador to Croatia. I asked him if watching the effects of the NATO bombing in the Balkans helped convince him that we should intervene now in Iraq.
The thing I came away with from the Balkans was, first, that intervention can do some good. There's no question that, but that in Bosnia, the United States intervention, the NATO bombing, saved many, many more lives than were cost by that action. It helped bring the war to an end. It was a war in which 200,000 people had been killed, and it enabled Bosnia to get on with the process of reconstruction, and it is admittedly slowly becoming a more normal part of Europe. Iraq, in the 30 years that Saddam Hussein has been in power, at least 500,000 Iraqis have died as a result of actions taken by Saddam Hussein. But sooner or later, I think it's likely to come to some kind of military action. If it's sooner, we're simply going to save the lives of Iraqis.
Let's look at some of the possible scenarios if we do overthrow Saddam Hussein. Scenarios for a post-Saddam government. What's your sense of what the best-case scenario would be?
Well, the nature of what follows depends on, in good measure, on how the war proceeds. In the best case, nobody wishes to fight for Saddam Hussein. You have a situation in Iraq in which 80% of the population are Kurds, Shiites, or Christians, that is from groups that have been brutally repressed by Saddam Hussein. They welcome the United States as liberators. And those segments that do support Saddam, which are very limited, come to the conclusion that there's no point in standing with a dictator who is, in any event, going to fall. And so you have an orderly process. That obviously will make it easier to set up a post-Saddam government than in some other circumstances. But I think necessarily there will be a period of U.S. military occupation, but I believe that we should move quickly to setting up an Iraqi government. I mean, the Iraqis are a sophisticated people with a high level of education. Iraq is today very much a third world country as a result of what Saddam Hussein has done to the country, but it wasn't. It was a country making great progress back in the late 1970s, and in which a lot of people have gotten educated, a lot of professional people, and those are the people who ought to be involved in rebuilding the country. Now, we're not going to find anybody inside Iraq who can be part of the government, except from the Kurdish area, which has been free from Saddam's control for 11 years, because anybody inside the country who might have opposition tendencies either has kept them very secret and is not known, or if it is known, he's in prison or dead. So I think necessarily a future Iraqi government should come from the opposition. It should be set up quickly. It should work with the American military occupation forces, but the United States shouldn't itself get into the business of running Iraq. This really is for the Iraqis to do, and they are very competent and able to do it.
How long do you think the United States would have to keep a military presence in Iraq in order to make it possible for, you know, a new government and for elections to proceed in some kind of orderly fashion?
I think it would take at least a year before you can hold elections. It's not just a matter of the the process of preparing for elections, of developing an electoral roll, taking a census. But there also have to be a process of purging the Ba'ath Party, purging the security services, which are pervasive in this society. In essence, Iraq is going to need to have a period of denazification. There will be some institutions that simply will have to be abolished outright. This would include the security services, Saddam's version of the Ba'ath Party. Other institutions will have to be completely remade. I think it's inconceivable to me that any person who has served as a judge in Saddam's Iraq could possibly continue to be a judge in post-Saddam Iraq, because inevitably this person has been involved in the enforcement of tainted law that grossly violates human rights. So that whole process has to take place, I think, before you can go to elections.
Peter Galbraith, you were America's first ambassador to Croatia after Croatia was established as Yugoslavia dissolved. And you know very well what happened in the Balkans. You know, it's a multi-ethnic region that started feuding with each other after Yugoslavia broke up and after that region was held together by a dictator. If the United States oust Saddam Hussein, do you think that there will be a lot of fighting between the ethnic and religion groups in Iraq, such as the Shia and the Sunni Muslims and the Kurds?
There is not a lot of history of intercommunal or inter-ethnic conflict in Iraq. But I think this cannot be excluded once the dictatorship is gone. Actually, I think the greater parallel to what happened in Yugoslavia relates to the situation of the Kurds. Yugoslavia, you had the Tito dictatorship. He held the country together. And then after he died, and 10 years after he died, with the end of the Cold War, there were democratic elections, and its constituent components basically split apart. And that was because, in the end, the constituent components of Yugoslavia didn't feel Yugoslav. They felt that they were Slovene, Croat, Serb, and so forth. Well, in Iraq, the problem is that the Kurds, who live in a geographically defined area in the north, who have been de facto independent for 11 years, don't feel Iraqi. Over the last 11 years, the Iraqi identity has been disappearing in the north. For example, the language used is no longer Arabic, but Kurdish. The schools teach in Kurdish. There's been a flowering of media, 20 television stations of different political views, all of this in Kurdish. For younger people, they don't really have a memory of Iraq. And for older people, the memory of Iraq is a nightmare. And so I do have concerns as to whether, over the long term, Iraq is going to be sustainable as a unified and democratic state, which are what President Bush has articulated as U.S. goals.
And just looking down the line, does that possibly lead to another war?
It doesn't necessarily lead to a conflict within Iraq if there is a clear definition, an agreed definition of what the boundaries of the Kurdish region are. But at the present time, that issue hasn't been settled. If there are agreed boundaries, then the separation of Kurdistan could be something as benign as the breakup of Czechoslovakia, which simply and divided into two countries quietly and with virtually no fuss.
My guest is Peter Galbraith. He teaches at the National War College. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Galbraith. He's a former senior advisor to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and served as the first U.S. ambassador to Croatia. The Kurds have a deep hatred of Saddam Hussein. He gassed the Kurds, and he exiled a lot of Kurds and destroyed some of their villages. You helped uncover some of Saddam Hussein's human rights violations against the Kurds. What are some of the things you helped uncover?
The first thing that I discovered was in 1987, when for completely fluky reasons, I was given permission to go to the north of Iraq, to the Kurdish region. And as I traveled from the last Arab town into the Kurdish region, I noticed that things that I expected to be there weren't there. There were villages on the map that we had that simply didn't exist anymore. And as I went on, I saw villages and towns in the process of being destroyed. For example, on one side of the road, there'd be nothing but rubble, and on the other side of the road, there'd be abandoned houses with bulldozers that were parked there clearly to continue the job of destruction. And it became clear to me that there was this process which ultimately destroyed 4,000 villages and towns in Kurdistan of wiping out the rural areas of Kurdistan. And the population was then being concentrated into what the Iraqi regime called victory cities, but what were effectively concentration camps of some 50,000 people each, in which the population was very carefully guarded without possibility of employment, dependent on government-issued rations. So that was one of the atrocities.
Well, let me stop you right there and ask you, what did you do with that information when you realized that Saddam Hussein was destroying Kurdish villages?
I was working for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at the time, and I included it in the report, which was part of a larger study that we were doing of the Iran-Iraq War. But frankly, at that time, like the Reagan administration, we were more concerned about what might happen if Iran won in the Iran-Iraq War. And so this information did not get a lot of focus. But I had it in the back of my mind. And a year later, when Kurdish villagers crossed into Turkey reporting that Iraq had used chemical weapons, I went back and I thought about those destroyed villages. And I put the two together. And I came to the conclusion that what was really going on was a strategy aimed at eliminating the Kurdish presence in Iraq, that this was, in fact, a policy of genocide. It wasn't completed genocide. It was part of a process. And so I went to the chairman of the committee, Senator Claiborne Pell, and said, you know, we need to do something about this. He agreed. He asked me to draft legislation, which I did, that imposed comprehensive sanctions on Iraq. It was called the Prevention of Genocide Act. Got Senator Helms, who was a very conservative Republican and the ranking Republican on the committee, to join him. Senator Gore, Senator Byrd, the majority leader at the time. And we got this legislation through the Senate in a single day. And then I went out with a junior staffer on the committee named Chris Van Hollen. Actually, he's just now been elected as a Democratic member of Congress from Maryland. And we went all along the Iraq-Turkey border talking to these refugees who had just come out. There were about 65,000 of them, and all of them, virtually all of them, had been witnesses to the chemical weapons attacks. And we interviewed hundreds who described firsthand what had happened, many of whom had actually seen family members or friends or acquaintances die before their eyes. But it was a very, very brutal campaign. Overall, we documented in that between the 25th and 28th of August 1988, 49 villages had been attacked. But it turned out these attacks had been going on since 1987, and perhaps as many as 180 villages and towns were attacked by Iraqi aircraft using chemical weapons.
Now, the Anti-Genocide Act that you mentioned passed the Senate, but it didn't finally pass Congress.
No, it did not. It was vehemently opposed by the Reagan administration, which, however, agreed that Iraq had used chemical weapons. But the Reagan administration's position was that taking action was premature. And so they were able to derail the process in the House of Representatives. I think it was a great tragedy that, this legislation didn't pass, because I think Saddam got the message that while his atrocious acts might generate protests, nobody, in fact, was really prepared to take action against him. And I think had comprehensive sanctions passed, he might have thought twice before he invaded Kuwait. He might have thought there would be consequences from doing it. Incidentally, it's often argued that unilateral sanctions don't do any good. But in this case, even though the sanctions bill never actually became law, even though it was simply a threat that it would become law, it did have one very positive effect, which is that Iraq never again used chemical weapons against the Kurds.
Now, something else you did regarding the Kurds, you were one of two people who smuggled out Iraqi documents documenting human rights violations and atrocities committed against the Kurds. What were the documents? How did you get them?
In March of 1991, there was an uprising in northern Iraq, and the Kurds took over all the Kurdish-majority cities and towns. And when they did that, they captured the buildings and the records of the Iraqi secret services as well as of the Ba'ath Party. They took these records to the mountains so that when the Iraqis retook the Kurdish area at the end of March, they didn't recapture, they didn't get the records back. I learned of those records in March of 1991 because I was in northern Iraq as the uprising was collapsing. But there was nothing to be done about it then, but I had it in my mind. And when I went back in September of 1991, because the U.S. had created a safe area in which the Kurds then had started to run their own affairs, I talked to Jalal Talabani, who was one of the two main Kurdish leaders, and he told me, indeed, that most of the documents had been rescued and moved to the mountains. So I said to him, I said, well, if they stay here, you know, there's a good chance that they will fall into Iraqi hands, and anyhow, they won't be useful. And so he said, well, I agree. I think they should go out of Iraq, but I'm not going to give them to the Bush administration. I just don't trust the American administration. He was very angry at the Americans for having called for the uprising and then failed to support it. So he said, I'll give it to you personally. Well, that was a bit of a dilemma because I didn't know what I would do with what turned out to be 14 tons of documents. But in the end, we were able to get them out, actually on U.S. Military aircraft, cooperation of the Pentagon. And then I deposited them in the files of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which meant they went into the U.S. National Archives. A special room was built for them below ground out in Suitland, Maryland. And then Human Rights Watch, the human rights organization, began to do research on them. And they turned out to be extraordinary documents. They were ledgers of executions. They included the orders for the destruction of the villages, what was known as the Anfal campaign. They included orders for the use of special weapons, which meant for chemical weapons. They included the tapes of meetings of the Northern Bureau. One of these tapes, for example, is Ali Hassan Majid, who was the Saddam's cousin who had been put in charge of the North, in which he talks about using chemical weapons. He says, we will use chemical weapons on the Kurds. Who will object? The international community, and here I paraphrase the language, to hell with them. So it is an extraordinary record from the point of view of the Iraqi regime of their activities. And of course, it mirrors rather closely what the Senate Foreign Relations Committee documented in terms of the use of chemical weapons and what the Kurds themselves have been reporting.
Why do you think a regime would document atrocities like that, document the destruction of villages, document the use of chemical weapons, document executions? I mean, talk about smoking gun.
That's an interesting question, but regimes do this. In the case of Iraq, I had imagined when I saw some of these documents particularly videos of executions and torture, that that this was being done out of some by sadists who wanted to who were sharing their sadistic products with the higher ups who would enjoy seeing people suffering. But as I thought more about it and looked more into it, I realized that that wasn't the case. These were bureaucrats in the security services who were making records of executions, who were keeping records of meetings, who were making videotapes to demonstrate how well they were carrying out their orders. Some of it may have been self-defense, so that they themselves could not have been accused of being soft on the enemy, and some of it may have been in the interests of self-promotion, demonstrating, again, how well it is that you are actually carrying out these instructions.
Peter Galbraith teaches at the National War College in Washington, D.C. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Peter Galbraith. He supports military intervention to overthrow Saddam Hussein and describes himself as a liberal interventionist. He teaches at the National War College and served as America's first ambassador to Croatia. In the late 80s and early 90s, while serving as an advisor to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he helped smuggle out of Iraq 14 tons of Iraqi files documenting human rights abuses against the Kurds. Have your experiences documenting Iraq's human rights abuses against the Kurds played a big part in your analysis that the United States should militarily intervene in Iraq and overthrow Saddam Hussein?
Looking at what the Iraqi regime has done, I've come to the conclusion that it is a fascist regime that bears close resemblance to the fascist regimes in the first half of the 20th century in Europe. It has an official ideology that glorifies one group, the Arabs, over the others. It has engaged in escalating atrocities against the minority that ultimately, in my view, but also in the view of Human Rights Watch, rose to the level of genocide. And I think that it is appropriate for the United States to take action, preferably with others in the international community, preferably but not necessarily pursuant to Security Council authorization, against regimes that commit genocide. Genocide is an internationally recognized crime, and there is a convention to which the U.S. is a party that obliges states to do something to stop and to punish the crime of genocide.
You've described yourself as a liberal interventionist. Is there a difference between a liberal interventionist and a Bush administration interventionist?
Well, I think that there is a place for intervention against regimes that brutally repress their own people, that engage in homicide and genocide, even when there is not some other strategic reason to do it. I suppose the best case would be Rwanda, where the United States didn't have any strategic interest, but a genocide was taking place, and I think we and others should have intervened to try to stop that. The Bush administration has made its case principally on the issue of the threat that Iraq poses. I think Iraq does pose a threat, but probably it's not the most serious threat that we face. For example, one shouldn't speak of weapons of mass destruction generally. There is a difference between chemical and biological weapons on the one hand and nuclear weapons on the other. Iraq is not going to be able to manufacture nuclear weapons under this inspections regime. North Korea is in the process of manufacturing those weapons. So if it was simply on the basis of weapons of mass destruction, then I think North Korea should be our priority. But there are these other issues, and because of the humanitarian issues, I place a greater emphasis on that, and that's why I describe myself as a liberal interventionist.
Now, you've said that you think President Bush faces the legacy of his father's actions and inactions. What do you mean?
Well, in February of 1991, the first President Bush called on the Iraqi people to rise up and overthrow Saddam Hussein. On March 3rd, a rebellion began in the south, and on March 8th, a rebellion began in the north. By the middle of March of 1991, most of Iraq was in the hands of rebels. Saddam was about to topple. At that time, President Bush took the decision to let the rebellion fail. Not just to let it fail, but actually to facilitate its failure. So American troops who were on the Euphrates Valley in southern Iraq permitted Iraqi Republican Guard units to pass by their lines and in some cases through American lines to put down the rebellion in the southern city of Basra and Nasiriyah and in some other places. In the north, General Schwarzkopf allowed the Iraqis to use helicopters against the Kurds. And one has to understand the role of helicopters in the Kurdish psyche. Helicopters had often been used to deliver chemical weapons. So for the population in the city, when they saw those helicopters flying, they panicked, they fled. The helicopters also gave the Iraqis intelligence that they could use to target Kurdish militia units. The final thing that happened is that those people in Baghdad and in the Iraqi military who were wavering, trying to figure out whether they should overthrow Saddam or not, looked at what the Bush administration was doing, got the clear message that the Bush administration did not want the rebellion to succeed, and decided to back Saddam. We are dealing, and as a consequence, Saddam stayed in power. We are dealing today with the failure of the first Bush administration to support the rebellion. Now, there's one other very important point about this. The first Bush administration has tried to slough off this question. They've always said, well, we didn't have a mandate to go to Baghdad. This has nothing to do with American troops going to Baghdad. That war was over on the 27th of February, 1991. We're talking about a rebellion that began after the war was over in March of 1991.
Well, what's your understanding of why the first Bush administration allowed the Iraqis to put down the opposition?
The first Bush administration was afraid of the people who were the rebels. This was a rebellion that began in the south, and it was a Shiite rebellion, and which was in the north and was a Kurdish rebellion. And so the first Bush administration was afraid that the Shiites would come under the influence of Iran, which is a Shiite theocracy, and they were afraid that the Kurds would try to create their own independent state and that this would alienate Turkey, who had been a key ally in the Gulf War. Now, there's an irony here because President Bush had actually called on the Iraqi people to try to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And, of course, the Iraqi people are overwhelmingly Kurds and Shiites. But the second problem that took place here is that the first Bush administration never talked to anybody in the opposition. There was a ban on talking to the Iraqi Kurds that continued until the beginning of April of 1991. So they had no idea of what the Iraqi Kurds were thinking. They saw them in caricature, and they saw them principally as people who wanted to break up Iraq and who Turkey hated. The irony is that I had invited the Kurdish leadership to meet at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The meeting actually turned out to be on the 27th of February, the day the war ended. I tried to get them in to see Richard Haass at the NSC. I was told that I was behaving irresponsibly by having contact with them. I was told that the administration's policy was not to get rid of Saddam, but not the regime, and they would certainly not meet with them. The Kurdish leaders then left Washington to go to Ankara at the invitation of President Özal of Turkey. In short, the U.S. administration was trying to be more pure on this question out of deference to Turkey's concern than Turkey itself was. So they didn't appreciate what the agenda was going to be. The irony is that in addition to the fact that Saddam is still in power 12 years later, the Bush administration was forced to re-intervene to save the Kurds in April, and by so doing, they actually created the independent, de facto independent Kurdistan that they were afraid of, and that entity has functioned for the last 12 years.
So how do you think these actions of the first Bush administration are playing out now? What are the repercussions now for President Bush?
The current Bush administration is not repeating those mistakes. Paul Wolfowitz, who is the Deputy Secretary of Defense, has known the Iraqi opposition leaders for many years. There are very regular contacts with the Kurdish leaders. They're developing contacts with the Shiite leaders. So I think that they have taken that lesson on board.
Well, finally, do you think we're going to be going to war soon? And do you have any sense of how soon?
I have no inside information, but my sense is that that we are going to be going to war, that it will be in the next 6 weeks to 2 months.
And you're optimistic about this?
Going to war is a very, very momentous decision, and war involves lots of risks, and there'll be risks to the Iraqi people. I mean, one of the things that I worry about is that Saddam might again, with nothing to lose, might again want to use chemical weapons. He probably would like to attack the United States. But he may not be able to do so. The people he can attack are the Kurds in the north and, indeed, even more easily, Shiites in the south. So, I mean, this could end up being very devastating for the Iraqi people. So I think there are lots of risks, but so I don't think anybody can be optimistic, but I do think it is necessary.
Peter Galbraith, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Peter Galbraith teaches at the National War College in Washington, D.C. He is, by the way, the son of John Kenneth Galbraith.